Well, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome you all to this lecture given by one of our more distinguished alumni, Commissioner Palaiochrasis, who was last in this theatre as a student when he was doing his BSc Econ and then his MSc in Transport Economics in 1958. And I always think it's a very nice sort of perk that we can offer our alumni to get their own back from time to time for what they have been forced by my academic colleagues to suffer in their youth. Well, after very successfully taking his master's degree in transport economics, Ioannis Palaiochrasis returned to Greece, where he joined as a civil servant those who drew up the first five-year development plan for Greece. And then in the 1960s, he increasingly concentrated on transport and transport economic issues and returned for a while to London. He was actually here in 1968 as general manager of Windward Shipping Limited. And following several years in the private sector, both in the UK and in Greece, he joined the government of Prime Minister Karamanlis in 1977 as Under Secretary of State at the Ministry of Coordination. And in 1981, he became Minister of Coordination. And anyone who's ever had anything to do with governments knows that it's the Minister for Coordination that is the key role. In October 1981, he was elected deputy for the Cyclades Islands, a post he held until 1990, surviving successfully all four elections that he fought. But in 1990, he was appointed Minister of Finance, and in 1992, he served as Minister of Industry, Energy and Technology until he went to Brussels as Commissioner for the Environment in January 1993. And it's in that, or as an occupant of that post, that he, of course, addresses us this evening on new approaches to the environment, a very interesting and provocative title, Environmental Crime and Punishment. It's a very, very great anticipatory pleasure that I now invite him to deliver his lecture.
Mr. Director, ladies and gentlemen, I'm really delighted to be after so many years here and, as you said, take it back. I must confess to you that I was delighted when the director and the European Institute of LSE invited me to deliver this lecture. But the pleasure proved short-lived. It lasted until I started pondering the question of its subject. When, after considerable thought, I chose to address you on the new development model, because this is what hides behind the provocative title of Environmental Crime and Punishment, I did so with mixed feelings of confusion and embarrassment. In fact, I felt, as I imagine St. Paul must have felt before addressing the Athenians, on the unknown God. My problem was, how could I preach to my alma mater, which still echoes with august sermons of great personalities, such as Franz Hayek, Harold Lasky, and more recently of my own professor James Mead, the virtues of an environmental model which involves such mundane things as solid waste, sewage, and all kinds of malodorous emissions. Would I not be considered a babbler if I advanced a new development model based on the integration of the cost of such things in our market economy? Therefore, as St. Paul, I searched anxiously for some common ground, the statue of some unknown God from whom I could start. I think I found it in our school motto, Rerum cognoscere causas. I propose to investigate together with you the res, the state of affairs of our current development model, the causas for which I believe it has failed, and finally, with an open mind, as our motto implies, search for possible alternatives, if any. Although there is disagreement as to the causes and the therapy, there is widespread consensus on the diagnosis of the current European crisis. It is generally accepted that it is more structural than cyclical, and that it is not restricted to our economies, but permeates our social, cultural, and even moral structures. As the European Commission's white paper on growth, competitiveness, and employment points out, the current development model has led to some serious structural imbalances. Among other things, it has led to a situation in which there is considerable underuse of human resources, of which we have a surplus, and an overuse of natural resources, of which there is an increasing deficit. Unless we subscribe to a perverse neo-Malthusian theory that rampant pollution will exterminate enough human beings to restore the balance, the unavoidable conclusion is that there is something basically wrong with our economic and social model. Let us therefore embark with a clear mind on the exercise dictated by our motto. Is our current development model obsolete? I have the strong suspicion that if this question were included in the Eurobarometer polls, it would receive an overwhelming yes. Nobody doubts that there is something wrong with our development model. To start with, in recent years, there's hardly any development. The little that there is hardly produces any employment. Unemployment among women and youth is the rule rather than the exception. Our populations are aging. Our social insurance systems are technically bankrupt. Our cities display all the symptoms of serious malfunctioning and have evolved into centers of social disorder and criminality rather than centers of economic, social, and cultural life. Above all, pollution and the general destruction of the environment are threatening the very survival of humanity. And yet, this development model served us well for many decades. In its post-war form, which was largely dominated by Keynesian economics, it was responsible for an unprecedented period of worldwide growth, initially centered on the West, but subsequently spreading to the newly industrialized countries of Asia and Latin America. What went wrong? Instead of answering this question, which would take a long time, I think we better ask and answer a more practical question. When did it go wrong? We all know the answer. It went wrong in 1973, and it went again wrong in 1978 when the two energy crises knocked out the bottom of our economies by quintupling oil prices and introducing the demon of inflation in a previously stable world. I'll show you two graphs which display this phenomenon. Here you have the stability of oil prices before the first energy crisis, the first big jump, stability again until the second energy crisis, big jump, and from then a steady decline. This was accompanied by comparable movements in the inflation rate and the interest rate, which is displayed in this diagram, this graph. Faced with these sudden deficits, both enterprises and governments resorted to large-scale borrowing, only to enter a spiral of further borrowing to meet their debt servicing. The banking crisis of the 80s was an unavoidable result. The various currency crises were another symptom. The near collapse of the stock markets in 1987, a third. The eurosclerosis, an apt term to describe the ongoing crisis. The current debate revolves around a series of questions. How permanent is the crisis? Is it cyclical? Is it structural? Is it both? Is it only economic? Is it also social? Or is it something deeper and more multifaceted? The Commission's white paper, which I mentioned, and which was approved by the European Council last December, gives some answers to these questions. But the white paper is only an overture. It calls for more research and more action. We have to go deeper into the causes of the apparent obsolescence of our current development model. And I suggest we revert to the question of when for a clue. The oil-producing countries precipitated the first energy crisis when they discovered they were receiving an inadequate revenue for the scarce resource of crude oil, which was rapidly diminishing. The industrialized nations reacted to this by a remarkable effort in energy saving and substitution of other sources in the place of oil. Taxes and excises on petroleum products were increased. Renewable sources of energy were subsidized. Electricity tariffs were changed from regressive to progressive. The use of natural gas was encouraged in various ways. The results were impressive, but unfortunately, as soon as international prices fell to relatively reasonable levels, action stopped, and it stopped short. Moreover, no serious effort was undertaken to analyze the energy crisis in depth and draw conclusions for the future of our development. Had this been done, we could have drawn the parallel between crude oil and other natural resources, which are increasingly in short supply, and which are even more wrongly priced, or not priced at all, such as forests, water, or clean air. We could have reflected on their overuse, on the mounting volumes of waste and pollution that this produces, and on the threats it poses for the environment. Upon reflection, we would have discovered that the historical accident of not including environmental costs in prices had led to such high exposed corrective payments and such gross price distortions that it rendered our development model obsolete. But let us go a little into the origins of our present model. No doubt they are to be found in the Industrial Revolution. In the space of a century, an agrarian society with a well-established pattern of rural areas, market towns and ports was transformed into an industrial society, in which the large industrial towns set the pattern. The strong-scale economies associated with industry and the external economies associated with the economy of that time were the prime reason behind an impressive urban growth, but the simultaneous emergence of strong central governments and administrations must also be noted in this connection. The advent of the railway made such concentrations possible by bridging the gap among sources of raw materials, labor, and markets, but it also made them more independent of the seafront. The inland canals had a similar effect. The prevalence of these two forms of transport led to the growth of cities in concentric circles around the main ports and railheads. Transport access assumed the familiar pattern of interconnected spokes with the rapidly growing urban centers in the hub of the wheels. The arrival of the motor car brought revolutionary changes in our lives and the pattern of our urban areas. Growth now assumes the form of bands along the main road axes. Motorized road transport has rendered most activities location-free, but at the same time, it is responsible for a new urban monster, the bottleneck, which we have unsuccessfully tried to exorcise with by, under, and over passes. A more logical solution would be to replace the present spoke-wheel road pattern with a gridiron system of motorways avoiding the main urban centers with suitable distribution links. Why this has happened in the United States but not in Europe? Here I think I can illustrate this point by a comparison of the road maps of USA and Europe. As you can see, the gridiron pattern is very clearly obvious in the United States, whereas in our case, you have a real pattern of spoke wheels and a heavy concentration in the center of Europe. What will be the effects of motorways and the great trans-European networks on the European scene? Let us admit that we have not seriously attempted to answer such questions because we have never taken the trouble to analyze such mixed phenomena and especially to relate them to each other. Another field which has not been adequately analyzed, we must confess, is the relationship among labor, capital, and technology. Increasing labor productivity induced by technological improvement was an undisputed axiom. Suddenly we realized that this axiom, in conjunction with the rising costs of a crumbling welfare state, has priced labor out of employment. Who has investigated these interrelationships from a development point of view? However, nowhere is the obsolescence of our current development model more manifest than in the environment. Environmental problems are not new. Neanderthalian cave dwellers must have suffered from smoke pollution. So have Londoners from the 18th century onwards. Nevertheless, these phenomena had never assumed alarming proportions. It is only recently that large-scale destruction of the environment, most of it generated in our urban areas, poses a serious threat to our survival on this planet. Industrialists and environmentalists alike have an easy answer. Development damages the environment, but this is a necessary or unnecessary evil, they say, depending on each one's point of view. The case of growth versus the environment is open. Even serious organizations, such as UNICEF, argue that we should slow down environmental action until we can get out of the recession. But is this really the case? I would like to submit to you that this is an almost criminal oversimplification. It is not all development, but dense and wasteful development that destroys the environment, especially if it is superimposed on an already existing urban structure without any respect or adjustment for the new features of growth. As I have already mentioned, the forces of concentration during the industrial era led to the growth of high-density urban areas. The interaction between density and land prices led to a vicious circle with the following phases: pressure on land, rising prices, increase in building coefficients, further increase in prices. The arrival of the motor car on the urban scene reinforced the vicious circle through the increased mobility it introduced and its own demands for road and parking space. You would be surprised, but I can give an exact figure. In 1969, 73% of all land in downtown Detroit was taken up by roads, motorways, and parking spaces, and only 27% remained built up. However, it was also the motor car that provided the means of escape from pollution and the deteriorating urban life to the modern suburbia. Whoever could afford it moved out. Soon industry and commerce followed, and the void left behind became a festering ground for the underground economy and all sorts of other illegal and marginal activities. As a result, land prices started falling in the inner cities. But instead of attracting back families and lawful business, they rather increased the competitiveness of the underground economy. The ease with which you can be lost, or rather the difficulty with which you can be found in these modern ghettos, is a highly priced utility and a basic factor of production in the underground economy. The end result is a constant increase in the average commuter trip, in traffic jams, in CO2 and NOx emissions, in plans for more motorways. The familiar vicious circle simply migrated from the center to the periphery of our urban areas and proliferated. It remains as one of the most serious current problems of the man-made environment, with profound economic and social implications that need further analysis. I think I have already given you enough evidence to prove that our current development model doesn't work. In fact, it has evolved into a kind of modern dinosaur, and the sooner we realize it, the better. However, a large number of people are still under the impression that this is not so, that we are passing through an unusually severe but still cyclical crisis, that we can get through it by resorting to the usual recipes. And then we can afford to resume our environmental legislation and control as part of the ongoing fight between the environment and growth. In order to persuade you that this is not so, but also in order to lay the basis for a possible structural solution, I would have to analyze a little further the implications of this development dinosaur on our lives. We can start with the direct implications. And first of all, direct implications on the economy. The fact that environmental costs are not covered when they occur, and more importantly, not by those that cause them, has led to huge outlays to repair environmental damage exposed. It is estimated that such corrective expenditure, which is mostly borne by the general taxpayer, amounts to 2 to 3% of gross domestic product in the United States, and to a slightly lower figure in Europe. It is obvious that such additional costs not only represent a subsidy for the polluter, but eventually impair the competitiveness of our economies. Another phenomenon, economic phenomenon, the underground economy, which can be associated to a considerable extent with the marginalized urban areas. The erosion that it causes to the tax base and the permanent fiscal deficits that follow are also proof of the failure of our current development model. In this conjunction, I should consider the more general failure of our tax system, which taxes the productive effort of human resources rather than the wasteful use of rapidly diminishing natural resources. In the case of the UK, an analysis of 1991 tax statistics demonstrates that only 7.5% of all tax revenue could even remotely be related to the environment. And I count in vehicles, oil, and gas taxes, while 65% comes from direct or indirect taxation of human effort. And I count here wage taxes, social security contributions, and VAT. In the case of Germany, which is considered a pioneer in environmental policies, the corresponding figures were even worse, 5% for environmentally related taxes and 80% for taxes on human effort. VAT is no doubt a good tax, or to be more exact, a better tax, but it does tax labor and profits. On the other hand, in our current systems, raw materials or energy or interest payments are expenses deductible from profits. Consequently, the present tax system gives an incentive to the European entrepreneur to use natural resources and capital in place of labor. And this is intensified further by the high social insurance contributions. The German figures highlight the exorbitant subsidization of the waste of natural resources at the expense of labor and profits. In the social field, the damage wrought by the obsolete development model is even greater. The dichotomy between place of residence and place of work has produced a society with a literally split personality. The daily commuter trip, the Jekyll and Hyde style of urban working and suburban living, is not only an economic waste, but a social catastrophe. The population left behind in the inner city ghettos consisting of underprivileged workers and pensioners, as well as the well-known marginal and criminal types, underscore an even worse failure of the system. No doubt, this so-called modern living has played a vital role in the disintegration of the family and the more general breakdown of social and moral structures and values. However, the area where the modern dinosaur has been most destructive is undoubtedly the environment. Well over 80% of all pollution is generated in our urban areas. We have already discussed the causes behind this. But let me add that the main cause is the lack of political will to apply proper solutions which modern technology and appropriate planning offers. In agriculture, another area with serious environmental problems, solutions are equally available. What is lacking is motivation and or coordination among central, regional, and local government, public authorities, non-governmental organizations, and last but not least, European authorities. Subsidiarity is often invoked to cover a multitude of sins. As matters stand, the amount of emissions, effluents, and solid waste increase daily and carry the pollution to the surrounding countryside, the nearest water bodies, or into the atmosphere. Most of our pollution problems have long ago overspilled from the local into the regional, national, continental, and now global level. The indirect implications. I shall only mention few headings. Rising health risks are the ones that catch the public eye more frequently. It has now been well established that there is a high correlation between the incidence of respiratory and cardiac disease, the ever-increasing number of cancer deaths, the alarming growth of mental disease, with the environmental degradation in the broadest sense of the word, which includes man-made environment. Genetic malfunctions are another chapter which I feel has not been investigated as much. Chronic unemployment is connected with our tax and social insurance system. Labor in Europe compared to the US or Japan is the lowest paid, but most expensive to the employer because of social insurance contributions, other fringe benefits or protective measures, as well as high rates of VAT. On the other hand, our unemployment benefit structure encourages people to remain unemployed. Demographic problems are not entirely unrelated to these phenomena. Birth rates in the rural areas are still higher than in the urban areas, because of the well-known fact that raising a child in an urban area is both more expensive and more difficult, especially for the working mother. I need not mention the fact that these demographic problems have led to the near bankruptcy of our social insurance and health schemes. Problems of law and order are also high in the preoccupation of the average European. Have we stopped to ponder how difficult it is to police an inner city area and how costly it is? More and more mayors and police forces that are faced with this problem, they find it easier to let sleeping dogs lie, or rather let criminals stay awake. Such policies, in conjunction with the rise of terrorism and the generalization of mafia-type protectionism, have split the threatened citizens into two groups: those that capitulate and pay protection money, and those that protect themselves through the use of private police services. The term defensive expenditure finds its literal application here. Another symptom of the failing model, the fast rising demands for infrastructure, especially the modern urban and interurban motorway, and the vast expenditure that goes into maintaining, running a car. Vast expropriation costs add to the already inflated construction costs. But as Professor Pierce pointed out 2 weeks ago, nobody calculates the social cost of road use, pollution, congestion, and accidents. And nobody charges it to the road user, let alone the enormous environmental costs of urban blight or other malfunctioning. What is the end result? Building more freeways. I still remember Professor Ponsonby, who taught me economics of transport, as you correctly reminded me, Director, saying in the mid-50s that there will always be a bottleneck at the beginning and the end of every motorway. A very simple but a very valid truth. What is our solution? Doubling the motorway. 16 lanes in M25 to take out the traffic jams. Have we stopped to consider that if we carry on like this, we shall spread over the entire countryside an endless marmalade of motorways and traffic jams? Shall I mention the word airport and its, the enormous controversies that airport plans have caused all over the world? Or shall I refer to the enormous infrastructure cost of renewing water supply and wastewater systems and constructing treatment facilities? I think that you have heard enough sermons on those subjects recently. Faced with the bills for repairing environmental damage accumulated over decades, member states try to shift the political cost onto the European legislation, as if it was the Brussels bureaucracy and not the people of Great Britain, Germany, France, Portugal, or Greece that need clean water and clean rivers and seas. I think this is another indicator of the current political attitude towards human health and the environment. Last but not least, let me mention the multi-trillion business of tourism and tourist real estate as another example of defensive expenditure, which the average European gladly incurs in order to get out of it all. After all this analysis, I think I'm entitled to pose the following question. Has the average industrialist or fellow politician who grumbles at the incidence of such a simple environmental measure as the CO2 energy tax ever considered the tremendous waste inherent in our current development model and its incidence on the competitiveness of the European economy? But now we have new elements in the game. And we have to explain why the model has become obsolete. What are these new elements? The first group of new elements is associated with certain basic changes in the structure of our economies. In the same way that at the beginning of the century the average European economy was agrarian, at the end of the century it is dominated by services. In fact, we live in a new information society. Moreover, the majority of the European economies have now been merged into a single internal market. The second group is concerned with the rapid advance of technology in all fields, but more pertinently in transport, in information, and in clean technologies. New technology generally promotes efficiency, reduces scale economies, is environment friendly, and calls for a new development approach. The third group is related to the fact that our environmental resources are rapidly diminishing. The depletion of the ozone layer, deforestation, desertification, the greenhouse effect, loss of biodiversity are particularly alarming. It is now widely accepted that this threatens the survival of coming generations. It is not an accident that the term sustainable development was coined in recent years. The fourth group consists in the positive phenomenon of a change in consumers' attitude. The mentality of the affluent society has come to an end. The average European has on one hand reached saturation point in satisfying many of his needs, while on the other is now conscious of the environmental dimension and of the need to limit consumption and waste. A trend towards more cultural and spiritual activities is also apparent. The fifth element is the whole new world of Central and Eastern Europe. Despite the present acute economic and political difficulties, it is hoped that these countries will soon enter higher stages of development and that tremendous size as markets and production centers will be brought to bear on the European scene. Most of these elements, which at first appear as independent variables, are interrelated and constitute the interdependent variables of the new development model. For example, the predominance of services in our economies, in conjunction with the new transport information technology, have rendered almost all economic activity location-free and have caused the disappearance of external economies from the production process. Contemporary high-tech and infotech industries, devoid of any serious scale economies, in the sense that its optimum size is reached fairly early. Industrial plants can now be located anywhere, even within residential areas, because of their relatively small size and clean production process. As a second example of these interrelationships, the new situation in Central and Eastern Europe, which I quoted, is bound to create an increasing flow of goods and persons with the rest of the European space. Our transport networks and our environment will be charged accordingly, and it would be inexcusable not to anticipate and provide in advance for this charge, especially in the field of the environment. Let us now proceed to our final task, which is drawing the conclusions from the preceding analysis. The case for the new development model rests on the basic move of incorporating the environmental dimension into our market economy. Contrary to what is commonly believed, the question is not whether we should internalize environmental costs or not. Environmental costs will certainly be paid for sometime. The question is whether to internalize them now, as they are being incurred, and charge them to the polluter, or pay for the accumulated cleanup or investment bills later at compounded interest and charge them to the general taxpayer. I think you will agree with me that this is really Hobson's choice. For I cannot imagine how anyone in his right mind could support the continuation of the monstrosity of subsidizing the dissipation of natural resources at the expense of labor and human enterprise. The real question for me is how the internalization can be effected. Conceptually, it will be done by abandoning the conventional treatment of natural resources as expendable raw materials, or even worse, as free goods, and considering them as natural capital, very much like the way we have traditionally considered land. Such natural capital would carry depreciation at a value proportionate to its degree of exhaustion, and all users would have to charge such depreciation as a cost item in their profit and loss accounts. In the same way as urban land is more expensive, urban air might be at a premium, and its use or abuse through pollution should be charged to the polluter proportionately. At present, according to a relevant German study, only 15% of the total annual damage to the environment is borne by the polluter. It is obvious that such gaps would have to be closed through an appropriate system of ecotaxes, varying in accordance with the natural resource concern and its depletion horizon, after taking into account substitution and/or regeneration possibilities. I know you can ask me 1,000 questions as to how this is going to be done in practice. I shall refer you to the extensive ongoing work on green national accounts and green accounting in general, carried out by Eurostat, the Commission Cellule de Prospective, the United Nations, many national statistical services, as well as professional bodies. Personally, I would simply like to add that humanity has never accepted the argument that progress should be stopped because it cannot be measured. This basic change would take care of many of the imbalances in the current model, notably the imbalance between the overuse of natural resources and the underuse of human resources. Through the correct pricing of natural resources, the relative price distortion between, for example, energy and labor could be corrected. And yes, we could see some substitution of labor for energy. Another beneficial result of the internalization of environmental costs would be that we would need progressively less legislation and regulation to protect the environment, a factor which should not be underestimated as the time lags and especially the difficulty of enforcement of environmental legislation make it a rather inefficient instrument. The second key element in the new model would be the correct use of technology. Instead of technology being used in the production process as a labor-saving device, which is mainly the case today, it could henceforth be used as a means of reducing the overuse of natural resources in at least three different ways. First, to produce savings in the use of natural resources as raw materials or secondary materials. Second, in reducing pollution, i.e. the abuse of natural resources. Third, in the development of modern systems of waste management, including collection, purification, reuse, recycling, recovery, and final disposal. Clean technologies lead to the growth of the so-called green industry, which may prove one of the cornerstones of the industrial renaissance in the European Union. It is estimated that rebus sic stantibus, between now and the year 2000, they may generate 3 to 4 million additional jobs. As proof of the growth potential of the green industries, I would like to quote two examples. First, the birth and growth of the Japanese environmental industries as a result of the Japanese energy saving and anti-pollution programs of the 70s. Second, the clean car industry, which created boom conditions in the Japanese and US automotive industries and led to pioneering research and the development of a new generation of engines. The European car industry caught on to this movement too little, too late, with poor results. These examples show that green technology is not governed by a simple cause-effect relationship. It is the result of the interaction of three elements: environmental legislation, notably in the form of future standards, changing relative prices in energy and other basic inputs, and economic incentives for directed, innovation-driven pollution prevention. The combination of these elements leads to targeted research and technological innovation within the market framework. So far, you may observe that I have not mentioned many new things. Indeed, most of what I have said you can find in books or reports. But what I have tried to present is a hopefully coherent synthesis of already known elements as parts of an integral whole, as interdependent variables of a new development model. And let me explain this a little further. We should not look at the internalization of environmental costs only as a righteous application of the polluter pays principle, but as a means of bringing into operation a new model of sustainable development. Environmentally correct pricing would save valuable natural resources, reduce waste, reorientate consumers and producers to environment-friendly products and production processes, stimulate technological progress, establish the right equilibrium in the use of labor, and at the same time have a profound effect on our patterns of living, including the physical aspects of our cities and towns. Technology should be used to advance the same goals rather than being taken as an axiom. Nothing should be accepted or taken for granted, and everything should be examined under the light of its repercussions on the other dependent variables of the model. As most of our modern activity and most of the damage to the environment is taking place within our urban centers, the new model should especially be brought to bear on these areas and our patterns of living. What are the implications of the new model on the urban scene? First, we should take full advantage of our service economies and the location-free character of modern industry and reduce the gap between home and workplace to a minimum. A recent study carried out by Finland indicates that the reduction of the average commuter trip to 6 kilometers, which is not a small distance, would produce for a community of 10,000 people an annual reduction of CO2 emissions by 4,300 tons, almost 1 ton per each inhabitant. There is now no reason why, in the majority of cases, we could not walk within walking or at least cycling distance from our home. Secondly, we should reduce both residential and other activity densities in our urban areas. Pollution, as I said, is produced not so much by the volume of production or consumption or movement, but by the concentration of it in a relatively limited area. Thirdly, we should work out the full implications of the new circumstances, as well as the new potentialities offered by modern technology, on transport and communication networks. This requires major research, but I may venture to say, by way of example, that future transport corridors will follow the gridiron pattern, which is more logical, and that home communication systems will increasingly result in teleshopping. The application of such solutions will produce revolutionary changes in the patterns of our urban and rural scene. Finally, we should embark on extensive urban renewal to adapt existing urban areas to the above pattern. Special attention should be given to the fusion of our historical city centers into the renewed areas. I'm referring in particular to the prevention of the aesthetic raping of historic city centers by motorways or so-called modern architectural creations. I think that the institution of an annual prize for architectural and engineering atrocities is well advised in this connection. The instruments of transition to the new model. The existing development model has been fashioned over a period of 2 centuries, if not more. It has undergone many gradual changes or even transformations. It would be entirely assume that the new model can be developed overnight, or indeed pretend that a blueprint is available. Despite the immense potentialities offered by technology and by our information society, this is a process that will take few decades. What is more, this is a process that will encounter heavy resistance from the vested interests. Let us have no illusions. The transition to the new model will be both drawn out and painful. We may now proceed to draw an outline of the principal means and instruments which should be used in effecting such transition. They fall under 5 headings: financial and economic instruments, education, research and technology, legislation and regulation, the development of a new model for human settlements, finally, international action and cooperation. Let me start with financial and economic instruments. The main thrust under this heading is to shift the burden of taxation or other levies from human effort to natural resources and pollution. In indirect taxation, taxes on CO2 energy, on NOx and other emissions, on sewage and other sources of water pollution, on tree cutting, on landfills, etc., could be instituted with a corresponding reduction in VAT, social insurance withholdings, and other indirect taxes on labor and profits. Excises could be drastically revised to reflect environmental criteria. Direct taxes on cars, other forms of transport, property, could be similarly revised on the basis of criteria reflecting their pollution capacity, their demands on space and infrastructure, as well as the aims of physical planning policies, respectively. Taxation of pollution could alternatively assume the form of pollution permits, which would entitle the buyer to a certain limited amount of pollution, beyond which taxes or penalties would be payable. Such permits would be tradable. Other forms of financial or tax incentives could be used to promote environmental policies. Grants or environmental tax exemptions could, for example, be given to industries which carry out programs of environmental investment or green research and technology or other voluntary environmental action. Finally, other equivalent incentives, such as an environmental logo sign or an eco-label, could be awarded to enterprises which on a voluntary basis conform to certain environmental directives, regulations, or other schemes. B, education, research, and technology. Since we are dealing with what is essentially a project to remodel our society, education will play a very basic role. Environmental education is already part of our curricula, but in its normative and protectionist dimension. This has to change to reflect the new basic axis of integration. Professional formation would also play a vital role, especially in connection with the development of environmental industries and the generalized introduction of green accounting. There are important lead gaps in carrying out environmental research, engaging in environmental technological advancement, or setting up environmental management systems, for example, in packaging and waste. These gaps have to be closed by grants or contracts or by advanced setting of environmental standards for future dates, which make it worthwhile to invest in a future potential. Having said that, I cannot but overemphasize once more the strong interrelationship among environmental legislation, advanced standard setting, and technological advancement and innovation. The combination of these tools with some fiscal or financial incentives may bring about revolutionary changes in the environmental scene in a very short time indeed. Legislation and regulation. It is good to use the carrot, but we shall still need the stick for a long time, even if it is only the cupboard. This is especially true in view of the fact that, as already stated, the process of integration of environmental costs in market prices is necessarily a long process. The legislative function should therefore continue, but on a decreasing scale, in proportion with the increasing integration of the environment in our economy. Moreover, the character of legislation, especially on the European level, should change from normative to framework, and harmonization legislation, making increasing use of voluntary provisions of advanced standard setting and other similar expedients. One basic piece of legislation in this connection is the harmonization of civil liability legislation on remedying environmental damage. On the basis of subsidiarity, more specific legislation and enforcement could be left to member states, regional authorities, or local government as appropriate. Let me finally refer to what I call the paralegislative function. This consists in various actions, mostly in the form of regulations, establishing a transparent reporting procedure on polluters and pollution. It may vary from green company accounts and eco-auditing to the toxic emissions inventory currently used in the United States. I view them as most efficient substitutes for legislative regulation, in as much as they do away with the need for enforcement and at the same time have a very strong pedagogic and demonstration effect. The accent should be on prevention and not correction. If I may revert to the carrot and stick simile, the aim is to progressively convert all Europeans to avid carrot eaters. We can then banish the stick to the basement and commission a study on its curative history. D, a European physical planning model. This is a natural apex of all the preceding analysis and the actions recommended above. It is at the same time the longest term effort, it should start with a very extensive research operation which would analyze the new economic, social, technological, and cultural conditions in the light of the desiderata outlined under the previous headings. The location of economic activities, job capabilities, densities, size and character of urban and rural settlements, modern transport and communication capabilities, energy production, distribution, and conservation, solid and liquid waste systems, and all other networks should be examined in interrelationship. The findings of such research should then be put together in order to develop a new model of physical planning which would lead to the sustainable human settlement of the 21st century. International action and cooperation. Practically all the above actions should ideally take place at an international level. Eco-taxes and other financial instruments would be most effective if adopted internationally. The same applies to education, research and technology, legislation on basic environmental protection and standards. Indeed, all these would ideally be decided on an international basis. It was in view of this realization that the European Commission was among the first to promote the idea of a green GATT, a new round to follow immediately the Uruguay round, which has just been concluded. Even in this round, we managed to include the creation of the World Trade Organization, despite opposition, with the possibility of an environment committee high on our agenda. Until, however, the new model gains worldwide acceptance, the beginning of its implementation in Europe or some other industrialized nations may create some problems of competitiveness. These should be addressed during the transitional period by the institution of eco-duties or other appropriate environmental levies on non-sustainable imports. These are the basic elements of the new model and the instruments to arrive at it as I see them in the first approach. They represent an attempt to overhaul radically our present development model, which has evolved into a modern dinosaur, as I said, by discarding all the obsolete elements in it. They represent an effort to lay the new environmental basis for the new model, not as a romantic, quixotic mission, but as a pragmatic incorporation of the environment in our entire economy. Finally, to work out implications of this cardinal change on technology, research, education, and the pattern and life of our urban and rural settlements, including transport, communication, and other networks associated with them. In fact, it would not be wrong to describe the new model as a societal project. I have no illusions about the size of the undertaking, nor the time and effort that need go into it. But I have the feeling that it is long overdue, that the present model cannot serve us any longer, and that a new one is urgently required for two very good reasons. First, to save us from the threat of an impending ecological holocaust, and secondly, to effect the structural change which is absolutely necessary for a new period of growth. In fact, it represents our only hope that the tale of the environment will not go down in history as a tale of crime and final punishment. At this stage, I shall be happy if I would only hear from you, as St. Paul heard from some of the Athenians, "We will hear thee again on this matter." I would be even happier if some of you, upon further reflection and testing, would find it worthwhile to nurse some of the seeds I so unwarningly threw at you this evening. Thank you.
Commissioner, it falls to me on behalf of your audience to thank you very sincerely for two things. First, for giving us so much to think about. Of all the lectures that we have had, even, dare I say it, from all those we've had from the European Institute. This has been one of the intellectually densest, and we are very grateful to you for that. But secondly, I think I should thank you for having done us the honour, as the European Commissioner for the Environment, of having delivered this lecture here. We're aware that the United Kingdom government is not always seen from Brussels as the most biddable and the best behaved of governments. And indeed, I don't think I'm letting out any secrets when I say that the LSE audience, as perhaps you noticed, is not always the best behaved of audiences. And so, thank you very much, both for coming here and doing us the honour of delivering this lecture, and thank you, above all, for giving us a lecture which provides us with such food for thought. Thank you very much indeed.